Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name is Pat, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm so nervous. I don't know why. I'm also totally preoccupied. I've recently lost weight, and I haven't worn this dress since I've lost weight. And I was getting dressed tonight, and I noticed, I got dressed, and I was combing my hair, and then I looked down, and it doesn't fit very well. So I'll be standing like this all evening. I'll try not to expose myself while I'm up here. Kind of like the way it used to be. I'm happy to be here and would like to thank the committee for inviting me. And it's true that, I've heard that Southern hospitality is the best, and that's true. I've had a really good time here, and want to thank you all for that. You notice I said you all? Kind of fit in here. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the way I live my life. I love the way that I feel. I can't believe that I'm the same person who came here almost 16 years ago. My life has changed so much, and I didn't know that was going to happen. I came here because I couldn't stop drinking, and I knew that somehow you didn't do that here, and so I was hoping that that would be true for me too, but I never dreamed that I would feel good. I just had no idea of the rest of the stuff that would happen. I am an alcoholic. I got drunk the first time when I was 13 years old. The reason I drank that particular night is I was at a party and they were drinking, and I wanted to fit in. I wanted those people to like me. I wanted to fit in, and so I drank. They were drinking rum and coke, so of course I drank rum and coke. I don't know how much I drank that night. Probably not much. When you're 13 and you never drank before, I don't think it takes much. But however much it took, I drank that much and then some. And that's how I drank pretty much until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. A magical thing happened to me that night. I relaxed. Really relaxed. I think maybe for the first time in my life. I have always felt ill at ease. I've always felt awkward around people. I've always felt like you all seem to have some ability to talk to each other comfortably that I certainly didn't have. And that night at the party, that went away. I could talk to people. I'm the kind of person, when I'm having a conversation with you, it's hard for me to concentrate while you're talking, because while you're talking, I'm busy thinking about what I'm going to say when you pause. I'm thinking about myself all the time. And when I was at that party and drank, that went away. I talked to people. I said things that made people laugh. I got up and danced, and I didn't feel awkward or embarrassed about it. And that's great stuff. I mean, it's magical stuff. It worked the very first time real well for me. Now, I also got drunk that night. I blacked out. I passed out. I woke up in bed the next morning with a Marine that I didn't know, which was not exactly what I had meant to do that night. I was a nice girl up until that night, and I felt real bad. I felt guilty and ashamed, and I was terrified that I'd get pregnant. I just had, a lot of bad feelings, and yet I drank again the very next opportunity I got, because it did that magical something for me. I didn't think any of that through. I didn't, any kind of insight that I might have, into what I was doing at the time, I certainly did not have while I was doing it, And incidentally, I didn't get it. I thought, when I was new in AA, I thought, well, when you write an inventory, that's when you really get insight. That was not the case for me. I started sort of understanding myself and getting a little bit of insight when I started sponsoring other women in AA. That's when I started to recognize myself and see, kind of what I've been doing out there. Anyhow, basically my story is I drank again every chance I got after that first time until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. For a while, I was a periodic. I was 13 years old. I didn't have access to alcohol every day. I believe that if I'd had access to it, I would have been drinking it because I drank at every opportunity that I had. I grew up in Newport Beach, which was a small beach community, and mostly we drank beer because that's what we could buy. Mostly it was on weekends, at beach parties. And I always behaved badly when I drank. I was always doing something to embarrass myself. Newport Beach was kind of a small town. Everybody kind of knew everybody, and at least in my school, they all kind of knew everybody, and I was developing this bad reputation, and that made me feel bad. I didn't want to be that kind of a person. Up until the time I got drunk that first time, I was one person, and it's as though another person jumped in my skin and took over that night and stayed in control thereafter. Up until the night of that first drunk when I was 13, I was a straight-A student. I went to church every Sunday. I was real involved in a church youth group. And those were all important things to me. I mean, those were things that I felt good about. Within 6 months of getting drunk that first time, I was getting C's and D's in school. I quit going to church. I dropped out of that youth group. I had a whole new group of friends. I'd somehow gotten a hold of a phony ID. which is a major joke. I'm 13 years old, I look about 11, and I've got an ID that says I'm 23 or something. People actually sold beer to me with that ID. excuse me. Great start, huh? I can hardly talk. We're 3 minutes into this. My life had changed already. I didn't notice it, but it had changed a lot. My parents noticed, and they didn't know I was drinking, but they knew something was up. They knew that that my life had changed, and they tried to help me, but I wouldn't have any of it. You know, they sent me away to boarding school my last couple of years of high school because they were afraid I was going to not graduate, and it had the desired effect. It was a very structured place, and there wasn't much opportunity to drink, and so I kind of buckled down and managed to graduate. And I got married when I was 18 because this fella asked me. It's true. I've searched my heart over the years looking for a better reason, and there just isn't. He was a nice enough fella. I like to mention that. You know, we stayed married 6 months and got divorced, which was certainly no surprise to anybody. And I felt real bad about that at the time, and he felt worse. He didn't know why we were getting divorced. He had no idea. He was willing to go to marriage counseling or do whatever. You know, he was willing to do anything to try to keep this marriage together, and I wouldn't have any part of it. And when I got sober, so I didn't see him in all those years. I got sober, and I ran into him one day. I was about 9 or 10 months sober, I think, and I hadn't seen him in all those years. And my very first thought was, God, you know, here I am. I'm in AA, and God puts this guy right in my path after all these years. It must be that I'm supposed to make amends to him for that. And what a great opportunity. And then my very next thought was, well, I'm not really sober all that long, and I'm not actually to that step yet, so I probably ought not to do this, and I didn't do it. And I like to mention that because I haven't seen him from that day to this, and I'm real kind of sorry that I let that opportunity pass by. You know, I really would like to have that. I'm almost 16 years sober. I really wish I could have crossed that off my amends list a long time ago. And you can rest assured that I remain ready and willing and able to do it if God drops him down on my path again someday, and I hope that he does. I have tried a couple of times over the years to track him down so far without success, but I believe if I'm willing to do it, it'll happen again someday. Anyway, I got married and divorced about that fast, and after we got divorced, I moved to L.A., and I got a job in an apartment, and I felt real grown up and real sophisticated, and I became a daily drunk. I was 18 and a half years old, I guess. It was the first time I'd really been on my own. Up to that point, I'd either been at home with my parents or in boarding school or married to this husband, and now I'm on my own, and I became a daily drunk. From the very first day I moved into that first little apartment, I became a daily drunk. My first job was for a trucking company, and I drank in these bars where these truck drivers drank, and you know, I've drank in some nice places over the years, and I've drank actually in worse places than those truck driver bars. But I think of all the places that I've been, I think I like those truck driver bars the best. They were terrible. They were truck driver bars. You know what they're like if you've ever been a truck driver, I guess. They're terrible little places. I one time was talking in L.A., and I mentioned the name of one of them and one of those bars, and a guy came up to me after the meeting, and he said, I can't believe you drank in that bar. He said, I drank in there for years, and I never one time saw a woman in there. Well, that's why I liked it, you know. I got a lot of attention when I was in that bar. I liked it just fine, thank you very much. And I was trouble. I was always causing trouble. There were about three or four of these same type of bars that we sort of rotated amongst, and I would cause trouble. I'd periodically get kicked out of one of them, and I thought that was just oh so funny, and we'd laugh about it and just drink at another place until they'd let us back in over there. And I was drinking in blackouts a lot, and I thought that was all kind of cute. You'd tell me the next day what I had done. We'd have a good chuckle over that and have another drink. And I really thought that I was about the most precious thing that had ever come down the pike, I want to tell you. I just thought I was the cutest thing. If drinking alcohol still made me feel the way it made me feel in those truck driver bars, I would not be standing here tonight. I would be sitting in a truck driver bar drinking. Obviously what happened to me, as I assume happened for you, is that along the line alcohol stopped working for me. It was still working then, though, but even so, I started having what I've come to know in Alcoholics Anonymous as sort of moments of clarity, even way back then, and I didn't much care for those. You know, I remember the first one real well. I was sitting at work one day. I was a secretary at this trucking company, and I was sitting at my desk, and to the right of my desk was sort of this picture window that looked out onto the loading dock where these guys would load the trucks. And I was sitting at my desk this particular day, and I felt somebody looking at me. You know, I glanced over there out of the corner of my eye, and there were four or five truck drivers standing on the dock there, all of whom I had known in the biblical sense, you might say, looking at me and talking and laughing. And it was humiliating. You know, I really wanted to die. I remember I couldn't hear them because this glass was there, but it was clear that they were talking about me. I remember I sort of turned and acted like I hadn't seen him and pretended to work and tried not to cry sitting there at my desk. It was so humiliating. And yet when lunchtime came, I got my purse and I went down to the bar and I had four or five drinks and a hamburger because that's what I do at lunchtime. And when quitting time came, I went down to the bar and drank until quitting time and took one of those truck drivers home with me. I don't know if it was those particular five or if it was somebody else. It was a fairly large trucking company and I got around. My father was vice president of this trucking company, and he called me one time. I'd been working there about, 7 or 8 months, and he called me one time and tried to talk to me. He was concerned, you know, and I got very angry with him, and I essentially told him to mind his own business. I can't actually repeat what I said, I don't think, from the podium, but essentially I told him to butt out, that it was none of his business, and how dare he try to interfere in my life. And the upshot of that was that we didn't speak for a good number of years after that, and it was really only after I got into Alcoholics Anonymous that we established any kind of a relationship at all. And we're not terribly close today, mostly because of distance, and we just don't know each other that well. But I love him, and we have a good relationship, and I've made amends to him for that, and I'm very grateful for that. But anyway, I left that job eventually because of moments like that one I just described to you. You know, I couldn't go in there and face these guys sober in the mornings. You know, I was young and I had this tremendous capacity for alcohol. I could drink a lot of these truck drivers under the table, and I thought that was something to be proud of, and I would do it and prove it, you know, a lot. But moments like this, you know, moment of clarity in the daytime were upsetting. And so I left that job. Although if you had asked me why I was leaving, I would not have, that's not exactly the reason I would have given you. I would have said that I was leaving because I don't think there's really any room for advancement at this particular company, which was no doubt true, but I think there's more opportunity at this new place over here. And I went over to the new job, and you know, I behaved on the new job exactly like I did there, and pretty soon I left that job because I don't think there's any room for advancement here. I think there's more opportunity on this job over here, and I'd go on to the new job and do the same thing there, and that's pretty much how I live my life. You know, I could stay about a year on a job, and by then I just humiliated myself so badly that, I couldn't stay. My standards were getting lower for, you know, what humiliated me, and yet eventually I'd have to leave. I one time left the company without even going, after an office Christmas party, without ever going back to clean out my desk because I just couldn't face them. The parts that I remembered, you know, in and out of the blackout were just so awful that I just couldn't even go back. I one time went out with my boss and several coworkers, and we were bar hopping around downtown L.A., and everybody was drunk that night. I was not the only one who was drunk, but when we wound up in the strip joint, I was the only one who auditioned for a job. It seemed like such great good fun at the time, you know. I got the job, and began what I like to think of as my show business career. I was this is actually when go-go dancing was sort of the hot thing in L.A., and there were some nice bars in L.A. that had, as far as bars go, you know, that had go-go dancers. I did not work in any of the nice ones. I worked in just some terrible, terrible places, and I met my second husband there. Now, you know, I can't, I'm just shy, tongue-tied, sort of nervous person that I described you earlier. There's no way I can take off most of my clothes and get up in front of you and dance sober. And so obviously I need to drink to do this. And so I would, a typical day was, now I kept my day job because I had to tell my mother something, you know, and so I'm literally leading this double life. I would get up in the morning, I'd go to work, I'd be dressed, you know, kind of like I am now, and I'd sit at my typewriter, and I'd do my work, and I'd be real quiet. I wouldn't bother anybody much. I wasn't getting a lot of sleep, so I wasn't talking to much of anybody, you know, and so I'd just sit there and do my work, and they all thought I was sort of this quiet, mousy little thing. And I'd get off work at 5 o'clock, and I'd drive down to Nick's or Joe's or wherever I was working at the time, and I would put on my costume, and while I was doing that, I'd have a couple of drinks so I could actually get out there on the stage and do this kind of work. And then I would work from either 6 to 2 or 7 to 2. That's a lot of hours to keep drinking enough to be drunk enough to do this kind of work but not so drunk that you can't. You understand what I'm saying here? I don't know about you, but I can't do that hour after hour after hour, just maintain a certain level of, you know, I don't remember ever undershooting the mark, but I often overshot it. The kind of places that I worked in were not the kind of places that it mattered much. More than once, more than 30 times probably, I just passed right out on the stage, crashed to the ground, you know, and they would just pull you off. They had a little sofa in the back room for this very purpose, and they'd take you back and just deposit you on the sofa, and one of the other girls would come out and work, and if you were fortunate enough to come through later and come back out, God, the audience would give you thunderous applause. They were so happy to see you, and, you know, I felt so loved and important and special, and it was wonderful. I met my second husband there. He was a customer in this bar, and I used to say that he clearly recognized talent. I must tell you that the truth of the matter is that dancing talent was not a requirement of the job. My second husband, to-be, came in there as a customer, and of course we fell in love. Now, this man was... you could line up all the guys in L.A. looking for a husband for me, and this would be the last one my mother would have picked. I'll just sum it up by saying that it turned out we were married for 11 years, and my parents never met him, and they lived about 50 miles away, so that's how they felt about it. So now here we are in wedded bliss, and now he drank. I mean, I never would have married him. I probably would never have met him if he didn't drink, but it turned out that he didn't drink quite as much as I did, and my drinking and my behavior became sort of a topic of conversation around the house, and things started getting a little tense. Also around that same time, actually, this is like a couple of years after we were married, but around the same time, I started getting arrested. And, I mean, I remember the first time thinking, what is a nice girl like me doing in a place like this? I couldn't believe it. I simply could not believe it. I had been to a Thanksgiving dinner at my parents' house that night. It was Thanksgiving. I'd been to dinner at their house. My husband, of course, wasn't invited. And so he had been at a dinner at his boss's house, and they took me down to jail. I don't remember exactly what happened. I remember driving home from my parents and stopping at a Skid Row bar to buy some cigarettes. I don't know why. Skid Row was not exactly on the way from there to there, but there I was. And coming out of the bar, and they had some winos lined up against the wall waiting for the wagon drunks, you know, waiting for the little wagon to come get them, men drunks. And they grabbed me, and they pushed me against the wall with these fellas. I could not believe it. They took me to jail, and I was highly indignant that they had done this to me, and they told me I could make a phone call. I recalled that my husband was at his boss's house, so I called the boss's house. The boss's wife answered the phone. I told her who I was and that I was in jail, and could she please have my husband come down and bail me out. I never for one moment thought maybe this would embarrass him or cause him a little awkwardness at work. I never for a moment thought about him. I never thought about anybody in my entire life but me. And yet when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and heard you talk about making amends, I remember for a long time sitting in meetings thinking, well, I don't really think I have anybody to make amends to. I mean, I don't think I ever really hurt anybody but myself, and I believed that for longer than I care to admit. Things kind of went from bad to worse. My next arrest was in Tijuana for obscene dancing. I don't think that's easy to do. You know, I'm not exactly certain of what it was I was doing that night, and I am grateful for blackouts, I'll tell you. I'm grateful that I had a lot of cash on me that night, and I was able to find my way out of that and get home. But you sort of see the developing picture here. It could be safely said that I'm not drinking like a lady, okay? This husband's really on my case here at home. I mean, we are really having these major, major fights, and sometimes it's violent in our house. Not terribly often, but just often enough to sort of keep me on my toes, you know, and nervous a lot. And I like to say this when I talk. It's not always a very popular thing to say, but I like to say it because it's the truth for me. I don't think there's ever a good reason for a man to hit a woman. But when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and started behaving differently, he quit hitting me. Something to think about for the victims in the audience, because that's the way I always saw myself, was a victim. Poor me. I never took responsibility for any of it. None of this is my fault. It's his fault. It's her fault. It's their fault. None of it is my fault. Truth of the matter is, my life is pretty much my fault, you know, and the way I live it today is so totally different. So he's on my case a lot, and these arrests are bad, and simultaneously with this, what is happening to me, which I did not recognize at the time, but alcohol was starting not to work for me. I never heard an expression like that until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I remember sitting in an early meeting hearing a man use that phrase. Alcohol had stopped working for him, and I knew exactly what he meant. And I knew about the period of time that had happened to me, and that's this period that I'm describing to you now. I was still getting drunk. I was still getting physically drunk. But it seemed like no matter how much I drank, I couldn't turn my head off anymore. It just didn't work. Or sometimes it would work for a little while, and then it'd be gone again. But I kept drinking for a good number of years after that, trying to get that magical feeling back. But what I did to get the heat off is I started drinking at home. And for the last several years of my drinking, I drank pretty much every night. I drank every night. Sometimes I went out. Most nights I drank in a rocking chair in my living room in a purple flannel bathrobe. And I did it night after night after night. I had a job. That wasn't much of a job, but I had a job. You know, it's important to have a job. Everybody knows that alcoholics can't work. See, I was thinking about my drinking a lot by now. I knew that I wasn't drinking like other people. I knew that I was in trouble. I have always been sort of a big reader, and I kind of suspected I might be an alcoholic. So I started hanging on to these little notions that, you know, would sort of protect me from being one, and having that job was real important. The job that I had by the time I got sober when I was 30 years old, and the job that I had then was so far beneath jobs that I sort of peaked career-wise at about age 23, you know. And then my job went downhill, and I had that last job because I could do it drunk. I could miss a lot of days, and that's why I had that job, and I was barely hanging on there. My days were all alike. I'd get up in the morning and go to work. I'd try not to drink at lunchtime because I knew if I drank at lunchtime, bad stuff was going to happen. And assuming that I got through lunch without drinking, I'd go home. I'd walk in the kitchen. I'd pick up the bottle of scotch, and I'd have a drink. Once I got that first drink and the bottle is here, I'm okay. You know, then I could take my coat off and get into my purple flannel bathrobe and settle in for the evening and do some serious drinking. But I got to have that first drink. I started trying to quit drinking on my own, though. I thought, you know, my life is going nowhere. I'm sitting in this apartment every night, drinking until I pass out. My husband's off at the racetrack every night. I'm playing sad records over and over and over again. You know, my personal favorite was Ray Charles, Born to Lose. Boy, did I like that record. I started that business of calling people on the phone, you know. Boyfriends I'd had when I was 12. And weren't they and their wives pleased to hear from me after all these years? And, you know, by the time I got sober, my mother was the only person who still would take my calls. My mother has always loved me in spite of what I was doing or how awful my life was. She would always talk to me. She would always try to comfort me. She would always try to calm me down. If there's nothing else ever happens to me in Alcoholics Anonymous except the fact that I don't torment my mother like that anymore, I'm so grateful. Other people, when they heard my voice on the other end of the phone, would say, "Not tonight, Pat," and hang up, because they knew. I was not one of those people who got to AA and had that great dilemma. I sponsor people who say, "But what about all my friends? What do I tell them?" I did not have that problem. I had no friends. There was nobody. This husband at home who despised me and my mother, you know. I started trying to quit drinking on my own, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. Every day I'd get up, and I'd say to myself, "I'm not going to drink today," and I meant it. I really mean it. I got to get my life together here. I am falling apart, and I'm not going to drink. And I'd drive to work, and I'd think, and not only am I not going to drink, but I think I'm going to go back to college and finish my education. And I'd drive a little further, and I'd think, you know, I'm going to start taking some aerobics classes or something and get in shape, you know, start jogging or something, really getting physical. Physical. It's going to be a whole new me. It's going to be great. But I'm an alcoholic. You know, by the time I get home from work, I needed that drink so bad. I get home and there'd be an open bottle of scotch on the kitchen sink, and I think to myself, well, it'd be real hard to quit with an open bottle. So I'll just drink this down tonight. Tomorrow when there's nothing in the house, I'll quit, and it'd be a lot easier to quit when there's nothing in the house. There's a flaw with this theory, and that is I'm an alcoholic, and before the night's out, I'm going to call the liquor store to deliver another bottle, and tomorrow what I'm going to have here is more or less a half a fifth of scotch, and we're going to do this again tomorrow, and again the next day, and again the next day. And I meant it every time I said it. Tomorrow, when there's nothing here, I'm going to quit. I never could seem to pass out right on the last drop, you know. It never seemed to happen that way. I remember sitting in my apartment one hot summer day. It was about 120, it seemed like. I was wearing that purple flannel bathrobe. It was about 10 in the morning. I was drunk already. Sweat is just pouring off of me. I hate myself so much. I hate everything about my life. I was sitting in that chair, and we lived in a second floor apartment. You could see into the neighbor's yard. And the neighbors were a young couple about my age, late 20s at that time, and they had a couple of little children, you know, toddler types, and the kids were playing in the sprinklers in the, on the lawn, and the mom and the dad were sitting on the porch steps talking and drinking coffee or something, laughing, and I cried that day watching those people because I wondered what they had. You know, I always meant to be living my life the way those people next door were living their life, and I don't know how this happened to me. I don't know why I'm not living my life that way. I just don't know how I got in this kind of condition. But I knew that day, beyond a shadow of a doubt, it was never, ever going to change. I had absolutely no hope because I'd been trying to change it for a long time. I'd like to tell you that I called AA that day, but I didn't. I don't know how long it was from that day until the day I called AA. I really was in blackouts a lot. I really have hazy time frame references, but somewhere between about maybe 3 months and 3 years after that day, I called AA. I was drunk when I called. I have no idea why I called AA that particular night, but I remember dialing the phone, and a real nice man answered at central office and asked me if I was having a problem with alcohol, and I said that I was and started to cry, and he stayed on the phone and talked to me a long time and told me a lot about himself, and I remember he wanted to send a couple of women over to my house. Now, I don't know about you, but I could not think of a worse idea than a couple of women coming over to my house, and I said something like, oh, no, thank you very much. I don't think I'm that bad, and he seemed to understand my attitude, and he talked to me quite a long while, and it was a Friday night when I called. He said, do you think you could not take a drink tomorrow and go to a meeting tomorrow night that's not too far from your house? And I said, oh, sure. So he gave me the address, and I wrote it down on a piece of paper, and of course I continued to drink after we hung up until I passed out. And I woke up the next morning, and I remembered making that phone call, and I didn't remember all of it, but bits and pieces, enough. You know, and I found that little scrap of paper with the address of the meeting place on it. Now, it didn't seem like quite such a good idea the next morning to go racing off to Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I might have just been a tad premature, but I couldn't get it out of my mind all day. It was just like right there in the front of my mind about that meeting. And I'm having dinner with my husband that night, and I heard myself say, I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. I don't know who was more shocked that I said it, he or I, but there it was, and he didn't care. You know, I don't think he cared whether I lived or died. He went off to the racetrack, and I dressed with some care. I remember I changed clothes several times. You know how we are, women. We, you know, I wanted to be right. Now, I've never been to AA. I don't know how to dress. I don't have a clue. I did not, God forbid, want to be overdressed. I can't think of anything worse than being overdressed. But by the same token, I did not want to be underdressed because I did not want you to think I had a cavalier attitude here. I was real serious. And so I remember I changed clothes several times. I remember this clearly because I remember as I left the bedroom, there was that pile of discarded clothing, you know, on the bed that I had. The outfit that I arrived here in, which seemed evidently to strike the right note in my mind, was rubber thongs, baggy jeans, and a knit top that all the knit had gone out of, you know, it just kind of hung there. I think maybe I was going for comfort, I'm not sure. I had two of these knit tops. One was red and white striped, and one was blue and white striped. They were exactly the same. Neither one of them had any knit left in them. And I wore them to meetings for about I washed them, you know, but I wore them to meetings for about the first month and a half. And then I remember coming to a meeting one night dressed in sort of a rose-colored pantsuit that I had. And I think everybody in the meeting told me how pretty I looked that night. And it made me feel good, and I started dressing better when I went to meetings, you know. Anyway, I went off to that first meeting, and I parked across the street from the church where it was held, and I could see people going. There were about 200 or 300 people at that meeting that night, and I could see them going down these basement steps into the church, and you know how we are. They're all laughing and talking and kissing and hugging, and I knew I couldn't go in there. I just knew it. But I sat in my car watching them for a while, and I thought, you know, these people, you people, don't know who I am. I'm going to walk by the church just to sort of, you know, check you out a little closer. I can't go in, but I'm going to walk by. This church was sort of in the middle of a block, and on the corner of the block, I was like over here, and then the church on the other side of the street, and then at the end of the block was a drugstore. And I'm thinking to myself, you will think as I walk by there that I am going to the drugstore, like you're really thinking about me, you know. And in fact, I'm sitting in my car. I'm a crazy woman sitting in my car. In fact, I'm going to go into the drugstore and buy something. Then you'll see the bag, see, as I come back. But I'm just crazy. And so I get out of the car, and I am going to the drugstore. And somehow when I got to those basement steps, I turned down, and I went in. And there was a man standing at the door who put out his hand, and he said, hello, my name is Clint. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went into that room. And as I said, there were a couple hundred people there, and they were milling around. It was a couple of minutes before the meeting was going to start. And now, it's 8:28 probably at night. I did not have a drink that day. I know you don't drink before you go to AA, so I didn't. But I'm a daily drunk, and I needed a drink real, real bad by 8:28 at night. I'm often already passed out by 8:28 at night, and so I was not in good shape at all. I'm in these terrible clothes. I'm shaking and sweat in buckets. Now, there's a fringe benefit of sobriety. I do not sweat like that anymore. I'm so grateful. So I'm sweating and shaking, and I'm going to cry any minute, and I know I smelled like a goat, and a man came up and asked me if I was new, and I thought, how did he know that? You know, and I really, there were a lot of people in this room, and I said, well, yeah, I am new, and it seemed like that. There were about 50 women standing there, and they're writing their phone numbers on little scraps of paper and handing them to me and telling me to call them any time, and I thought that was real nice, and I put them in my purse, and they found me a seat, and the meeting started, and a man by the name of Norm Alpey talked that night, and this guy made me laugh. When this guy talked, I kind of relaxed. You know, I identified with some stuff that he talked about. And in fact, we drank in one of the same places, many years apart. He was a much older man, but I identified. What happened that night, and I didn't even know it, but what happened to me that night is I got some hope, you know. I bought the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous before I left the meeting that night, and I went home, and I stayed up most of the night reading it. And I remember thinking, geez, this is great. I'm going to go to that meeting every Saturday night and be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard you say at that meeting that I should be going to a lot of meetings, and it seemed to me that every Saturday night would be a lot of meetings. You know? I didn't drink till Friday. 6 days in a row, I did not drink. And I want to tell you, I was impressed. Every day, I remember thinking, wow, AA really works. This is phenomenal. I'm not drinking. This is really great. And then on Friday night, I was just kind of struck drunk. Couldn't believe it. I remember thinking, it is as though I came to in the middle of this drunk, and I remember thinking, well, I can't be drunk. I'm in AA now. But I was drunk, all right. And I went back to that meeting on Saturday night, and I raised my hand for being under a week of sobriety, as they asked us to do there. And I got more phone numbers at this meeting and at the second meeting, and one of these ladies suggested I might find it helpful to actually call one of these numbers before I took a drink, that some of you had found that to be helpful. And I thanked her, and I drank a couple more times that week, and then I called that lady who said that to me, and I was drunk when I called her. And she said, you know, you seem to be having just a little trouble grasping the program here. You might find it beneficial to have a sponsor. I had no idea what that was, which is probably just as well, or I probably wouldn't have done it. I said, well, okay, would you be my sponsor? And she seemed sort of pleased to be asked. And she said, why don't you meet me early before the meeting tomorrow night, before anybody else gets there, and we'll have an opportunity to sit down and talk about it. Tomorrow night happened to be a Thursday. That's not meeting night. But I did want to get off on the right foot with this woman, so I said, well, okay. And so she told me where to go, and I went over to a different church, and nobody was there yet. We sat in the back of the hall. She had asked me on the phone if I had a big book, and I said, yeah, and she told me to bring it, and I did. And so we sat in the back of this hall, and the first thing she did is she opened up my big book to the front cover and handed me a pen and told me to write the date in there. And I wrote that day's date in there, and she said, that's your sobriety date. And I thought, boy, I shouldn't have done that in ink. No, I really shouldn't have done that. I'm very happy to report that is my sobriety date. August 28th, 1975, for those who care. Then, thank you. I'll clap for that. Then she took the meeting directory that lists all the meetings in the LA area, and she started circling meetings for every night of the week. She's saying, with a smile, you know, like, this is going to be fun. On Monday night, you'll go here, and Tuesday night, we all like this meeting, and Wednesday night, this is the best meeting. I could not believe it. I said, excuse me, but this is never going to work. I'm a married woman. This is totally out of the question. And she said, well, maybe you can do this on less, but if you want me to be your sponsor, this is what I would expect you to do. She said, I'll never ask you to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous that I haven't done. But if you want me to be your sponsor, I assume it's because you want what I have. And if you want what I have, I only know one way to get it, and that's to do what I do. I could not think of a snappy comeback to that. And so I said, well, all right, I'll do it, but I'll tell you what, my husband isn't going to like this one little bit. She told me it didn't matter if my husband liked it. She told me, in fact, it didn't really matter if I liked it. She said, I promise you, if you don't drink, and you come to these meetings, and you take these steps, your life will change for the better. She promised me that. Now, of course, I didn't believe her, but I did start going to the meetings every night. And you know, when I look back on it, I cannot believe that I did it. I can't believe I went to those. I was right. My husband did not like it one little bit. You know, for years, he knew where to find me. I was in that purple flannel bathrobe in a rocking chair in the living room, which is not to suggest I was a wonderful wife, but at least he knew where I was. You know, now I was gone every night, and he did not like it. we fought, you know, it kind of gave us a new focus for our fights. Now we're fighting about AA. You know? And he thought I was coming here to meet men. Now, that was not an unreasonable guess on his part. I had always cheated on him. I cheated on him the first week we were married, continued to cheat on him throughout. I didn't much in those last few years in the rocket chair, mostly because, you know, there's not a lot of traffic coming through your living room. But I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was not cheating on him. Now, I was perfectly willing to here, but none of the men in AA seemed to be interested in me. And it really, you know, it ticked me off that he's accusing me of something I'm not doing right at this minute. And we had a lot of trouble. And so I would, I felt so sorry for myself. You know, I thought, I really, really, truly thought I had the saddest life of anybody who ever came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I cried at every meeting I went to. My direction was to get to the meeting an hour early, shake hands with everybody in the room, and ask them how they were. Like I care, you know? And so I'd go to the meeting. Now, here's a typical day. I'd get up in the morning, I'd go to work, I'd come home, we'd have dinner, we would have the fight. Same fight every night. I'd get in the car, I would be sobbing hysterically. It is a miracle I was not killed in a car accident driving to a meeting because I sobbed. And I'd think, I can't do it. If this is sobriety, you can have it. I'll go to your meeting tonight because I'm already out of the house. This is the last one I'm going to. And I'd get to the meeting and I'd go around and I'd shake everybody's hand in the room and ask them how they were. And here's how I'd do it. I'd go, "Hi, Fred, how are you?" And he'd say, "Fine, Pat, how are you?" And I'd tell him, you know. And till his eyes would glaze over, and then I'd move on to the next person, you know, kind of work the room like this. And you were so kind to me. You'd pat me on the back, and you'd say stuff like, "Keep coming back, it gets better a day at a time." It's not, it's getting worse, but you were very kind to me. One night when I was about 3 months sober, and I came to my home group meeting, I believe if I have anything at all that's important to say in Alcoholics Anonymous, this is probably it right here coming up. So listen up, newcomers. Then you can go back to sleep. I came to my home group meeting, and I was crying, of course, because that's what I do. And I'm sort of working the room there, and I went up to this guy, Larry, in the group, and I said, "Hi, Larry, how are you?" And he said, "Fine, how are you?" And I started to tell him, and he cut me right off in mid-sentence. He said, "I don't want to listen to that. Why don't you go find a newcomer to talk to? Perhaps you'd feel better." And he pointed to some girl on the other side of the room. He said, "There, over there in the red dress. She's brand new. It's her first meeting. Go talk to her." I hated Larry so much that night. I knew if I didn't go talk to this girl, Larry would tell my sponsor. So I thought, well, maybe I'll just go say hello here. I mean, it was a big room. It took me a few minutes, you know, to kind of work my way over to this girl. And, of course, I wasn't exactly rushing either. But as I'm walking over to this girl, I am thinking to myself, I don't care if she lives or dies. That was my exact thought. I do not care anything for anybody but myself. And I'm walking over there. I'm so sullen and resentful. And I stick out my hand and I say, "Hello, my name is Pat." And the girl who had 12-stepped her and brought her to the meeting that night, who I knew, said, "Oh, Pat, I am so happy to see you. This is," whatever this girl's name was, "it's her first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. She had this big fight with her husband about coming to AA, and I've been waiting for you because I knew you were just the right person to talk to her." You know how things flash through your mind real fast? I had one of those moments, you know. My first flash was, well, I'm absolutely the wrong person to talk to her because it's not working at all for me. You ought to find somebody a little happier here to do this job. But my second thought was, well, it's not working for me. See, I overlooked the part where I was sober. All I could see was how unhappy I was. I thought, it's not working for me, but if this is this girl's first meeting, I really ought to try to say something positive or encouraging. I mean, it really would be the nice thing to do. I opened up my mouth and I heard myself say, of all things, "Keep coming back. It gets better a day at a time." I could not believe I said that. My nose is going to grow. You know, this is not true. And I talked to this girl for maybe 20 seconds more. I mean, I know I didn't talk to her a full minute. I know I didn't. I wouldn't have. I turned and I walked away. And I was walking back across the floor, and I had one of those moments, sort of a little moment. I like to think of it sort of where God reaches down and taps you on the head and kind of gives you a little message there. And I got it that night. I realized that it was the first time in the 3 months that I'd been sober, from the period of time that I hit the door until the meeting actually started, that I was at a meeting not crying. And the reason was real clear, because for 30 seconds or a minute or whatever it was, I thought about somebody besides myself. You know, for just that little brief period of time, I tried to say something positive or encouraging to this girl, and I felt better. Nothing about my life changed. My life was still the same terrible life it was a minute ago, but for that long, I tried to think of somebody else, and I felt better. It is a fact that when I am thinking about you, I cannot be thinking about me at the same time. And any time that I am not thinking about me, I'm having a better day. and so is everybody in my immediate vicinity having a better day, you know? There's a line in the Big Book, in fact, there's many lines in the Big Book that refer to the fact that, that when all else fails, working with another alcoholic will save the day, that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as working with another alcoholic. It's the truth. It's the whole key to the program, as far as I'm concerned. It's what works. It worked that night when I was 3 months sober and had very little experience, strength, and hope to share, and it works tonight when I'm 15 plus years and have that much more experience to share. And if you're new, that's all I have. I'm not any kind of an expert here. I don't know much about the disease of alcoholism or anything. But what I know is how I have stayed sober for these 15 years. I know that real well. And so long as I'm willing to share that with you, I not only get to stay sober, but I get to feel pretty good most of the time. And that seems like a pretty fair trade-off to me, you know. To go back, I'm there, I'm whining around the meetings, you know, I've just got this bad attitude. I mean, it's my husband's fault. I take no responsibility for anything that's going on in that house. If it wasn't for him, my life would be perfect. With an attitude like that, inevitably, I met a man in a meeting one night who looked good to me, you know. I was about 10 months sober, he was about 10 minutes sober. I could see him like it was yesterday. He had a Fu Manchu mustache and a shaved head, and boy, my heart started to pound. He looked so good. I leaped across some chairs to introduce myself to him, and my sponsor noticed and beckoned me off to the side of the room and reminded me gently that I was a married woman. And I said, "Yeah, but I'm so unhappy." And she said, "Nonetheless, Pat, you are married, and as long as you're married, I expect you to act like a married woman." I said, "Hey, no problem. I'll get divorced." You know. She said, No. We don't make any major moves in our first year of sobriety." But I was obsessed, you know. I just knew this man was the answer. I knew it. He was the answer. So, you know how this goes if you've been around AA any time at all. You know, we kind of danced around each other in meetings. You know how this works. And it was complicated. I mean, I'm married. Obviously, we're not going to go to my place. He's a newcomer. He doesn't even have a place. He had a job. He had a job, actually, very conveniently to where I was working. I was working at this time at a record company in Hollywood, and he was also working in Hollywood. Isn't this great how these things work out? He was working in Hollywood at this porn bookstore, and I arranged this long lunch hour one day, you know, for somebody at work to cover for me, and I went down to the bookstore and picked him up. He didn't have a car either, and we drove up to a motel on Sunset Boulevard and spent some time together, and I drove him back to the bookstore and dropped him off. And I'm driving back to my office that afternoon, and it struck me that I was 10 months sober, and I was living exactly the way I had always lived. I'd been sitting in these meetings for 10 months, hearing you say night after night after night that I was going to have to change everything about the way I lived, or I was surely going to drink and die. Now, I don't know what I was thinking during those 10 months. Surely I was not thinking it didn't apply to me, but I'm afraid maybe that is what I was thinking. But I knew that day in the car, driving back to my office, that I was in a lot of trouble, because I've always lived that way, and I don't think I can change. I've tried to change before, and I can't do it. I was also terrified to tell my sponsor what I'd done, because I was pretty sure she'd cut me loose. She had been very clear in her direction about this fellow. But I did tell her that night, and she said to me, "You know, Pat, you've learned a real important lesson here today. You've learned that you are probably not a woman who could cheat on her husband and stay sober, and you didn't have to take a drink today to find that out. And you just don't have to live that anyway, that way anymore if you don't want to." I didn't want to. With all of my being, I did not want to live that way anymore. But wanting that did not make the obsession for this man go away. The obsession for this man was as great as it was the moment I first laid eyes on him. What I did... so simple when I talk about it. It was not that easy at the time. What I did is a day at a time, I stayed away from him. A day at a time, I did not call him at that bookstore. A day at a time, I did not drive by his house. A day at a time, I didn't drive by his work. A day at a time, I didn't take his calls when he called me at my office. I just simply didn't take his calls. I ran by my sponsor the notion that maybe I ought to call him up and explain to him what was going on here. She assured me that if I just quit talking to him, he'd get the idea. Evidently he did, because eventually he stopped calling me. And the reason I like to talk about that is the obsession went away. And the real good news for me is that I don't live that way anymore. And I haven't had to live that way since then, you know. What a gift. What an incredible gift to this program. I've always lived that way. And ever since, you know, I was 13 years old, I've lived like that. And here I was, 31 years old in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm changing my life. I couldn't believe it. You know, what a gift. I kind of kept marching along. I'd like to say something else about that, too. I think it's important today. I mentioned to you that that I had a lady at work cover for me so I could go out and do that day. You know how you have a friend at work who's like the person you tell your stuff to, you know? And she knew where I was going and what I was doing. In fact, we talked about it after I got back. And 6 months maybe after that incident, I quit working for that company, got a better job, and moved on. But I stayed in touch with that lady. We were friends, and we'd have lunch together occasionally or whatever and talk. And about 2 years later, I heard through a third friend, a mutual friend, that this first lady's husband had developed a really bad drinking problem, and that they had joined some sort of kind of bizarre church in the hopes that it would stop him from drinking. And when I heard that, I thought to myself, well, that's strange. I wonder why they would do that. She knows a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous because we talked about it a lot. I wonder why she wouldn't suggest AA to him. And then I thought, well, now why would she? What she saw of Alcoholics Anonymous is that it's a place where people cheat on their spouses. Why would she want to take her husband there? You know, it made me feel real bad. You know, I believe that if we're going to let people know, the people around us know that we're sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a real obligation to behave in a way that would make it an attractive program to them. We never know who's looking at us. We never know. I mean, that woman would be the last person in the world you'd ever think would have a drinking problem. She'll never be an alcoholic, but how was I to know her husband would be? You know, you just don't know who you're carrying the message to by the way you behave, and it really made me start taking a close look at how I was behaving out there. I feel real bad about that guy. I hope he got sober someday, but I'll tell you what, if he did, it's no thanks to anything I had to say or do. I've made a conscientious effort to be a better example on subsequent jobs and other places where I am, where people know that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, to go along, when I was a year and a half sober, my sponsor drank, and I got a new sponsor who was sober a long time, and I wondered what this woman had. She had happy, joyous sobriety. I wasn't even close, you know. I wasn't drinking, and I was struggling along with these steps, but I wasn't very happy. And the first thing we talked about was this marriage I was in. She said, you know, I've watched you since the day you got sober, and it seems to me all you do is whine and snivel and complain about this husband, which was true, I guess. And she said, I want you a day at a time to act like you're a kind and loving wife to this man. It was not an appealing idea. I didn't like him. He wasn't too crazy about me. I remember we talked. I said to her, I do not think this marriage can be saved. And she said, maybe not. Maybe you're going to have to walk away somewhere down the road. But today, while you're still there, I want you to act like a kind and loving wife. She said, if you just do that, then maybe somewhere down the road, if you do have to walk away, maybe you'll be able to do it without any guilt, because maybe you can make some amends in the meanwhile for some of that terrible stuff you did to this man. Guilt was kind of the word that got my attention in there, because I felt so guilty, and there didn't seem to be any good way to make amends for all that cheating and stuff that I'd done. You know, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is very clear that you can't make amends when to do so might injure that person or others, and so obviously that means you can't go home and confess infidelities to your husband that he maybe didn't know about, you know. But I knew about him, and they were driving me crazy, and so when she suggested maybe this was a way of doing that, I became willing to try it. So now I'm going home every day, and I'm pretending to be a kind and loving wife. And I'm like an actress here now, you know. I'm just pretending, and it was hard. Some days it was not so hard. Other days it was impossible. But I did the best I could. This woman taught me so much about being a wife. Remember, her very first direction was I was to go home every day and ask him how his day was and listen while he told me. I did not have the slightest interest in how his day had been. My direction was to listen for a minimum of 10 minutes. I actually checked my watch the first couple of times and asked him, you know. I remember the first time I did it, he looked kind of startled that I was asking. But he told me a couple of things that had happened at work that day, and none of it made any sense. I mean, I didn't know the people he was talking about from work or anything. But, you know, as time passed, his stories from work started to make some sense because the names started to have some familiarity to me and so on. But that night, he just told me a couple of things that happened at work. When the 10 minutes were up, I left the room, and we had dinner, and we had the same fight we always have, you know, when I left the house. But I was in the car driving to the meeting, and I wasn't crying that night. I didn't understand that for a long time. Why aren't I crying? Nothing's changed. We had the same fight we had every night for a year and a half. And, you know, I know today the reason I wasn't crying is because I'd finally taken my focus off of the problem, and I was busy in the solution. You know, the minute I get busy in the solution, it seems like I feel better, no matter that the problem is still the same. You know, I've taken my focus off of it, and I do a lot better. I kept marching along and doing this stuff that this lady was suggesting to me, and I started watching married people in Alcoholics Anonymous and trying to incorporate some of that stuff. Some of it was just too awful to even consider, but I took what I could, you know, and I tried to act as though I were a kind and loving wife. And one night I was on my knees saying my prayers, which were pretty simple in those days. I would get on my knees in the morning and say, Dear God, please help me stay sober today. Amen.
And at night I would get on my knees and say, Dear God, thank you for keeping me sober today. Amen. I said those prayers because my sponsor told me to. I believe in God. I've always believed in God, but I certainly did not feel any connection. You know, I mostly was embarrassed about being on my knees. I always did it when my husband was in the other room. And if I thought I heard his footsteps, I'd leap to my feet, you know, so he wouldn't see me doing this. And I'm on my knees this particular night saying that prayer, Dear God, thank you for keeping me sober today. Amen. And I started to get up, and I realized that I was comfortable in that house with that husband. And it hadn't happened that day. It had happened a long time before, and I'd missed it. I couldn't believe it. I remember I thought, okay, it was yesterday then. But no, yesterday was a good day too. And the day before was good. I don't remember when it happened. It was just a phenomenal realization. I mean, this is the biggest problem in my life, and I didn't even notice when it went away. I got back down on my knees, I'll tell you. And I thanked God for this new feeling. I said, God, I believe if you mean for me to stay married to this man, I could do this and have a happy and joyous life. And I thanked him for this sober life. And it's the first time I thank God for anything other than just my physical sobriety. I couldn't believe it. Not too long after that, we found out that he had cancer. My very first reaction to the news that he had cancer was, boy, I wish this would have happened when I hated him. See, right away, I think about me. How is this going to affect me? How am I going to feel? I'm a selfish, self-centered woman. That's just who I am. I'm happy to report I don't act on it nearly as often as I used to, but basically that's who I am, and I always think of me first. The good news is that I didn't change anything that I was doing. I just kept doing what I'd been doing. He was sick for a year and a half, and he did die. And it was a tough year and a half, but it was also the best year and a half of our marriage. By a million miles, it was the best year and a half of our marriage because of what you taught me how to do. You taught me how to do that. When he died, I went down to this little chapel, and I made some funeral arrangements. And the day the funeral came, and a couple hundred people from Alcoholics Anonymous showed up that day. Now, none of those people ever met him, but they came that day because they figured, you know, that I would need them, which, of course, I did. And I realized sitting in that chapel that what my sponsor had promised me had happened. I felt no guilt. You know, I felt sad about his death, but I felt right and whole and complete about my partner relationship. I knew that I had made my amends totally to this man, and I felt comfortable, you know. It really was a good feeling. It really was unbelievable to me that it could have changed so much in a relatively short period of time. It really made a believer out of me that these steps, in fact, will work in every area of your life. I used to hear people say that. And people would say from the podium, whatever your problem is, the answer is in the big book. I'd go home and I'd go leaping through there looking for it. I could never find it. They're there. Keep looking. After my husband died, I started dating a man that I had met in Alcoholics Anonymous, a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd known him since the day I got sober. He's sober a couple more years than I am. He's in my home group. He'd been my friend for the years that I've been sober. I never dated a friend before. My whole life, I never dated a friend. And now I'm dating this friend, and we got married eventually, and we have a great life together. You know, we're both very active members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if we have one great whine in life, it's that we don't get to spend enough time together, and it's a joke when we whine about it. I mean, the reason we don't get to spend enough time together is because of AA stuff, that, you know, he's going here, I'm going there, whatever, and we whine about that. If it wasn't for AA, we wouldn't have any of it. I mean, how can we even think of whining about this? I can't believe it. We laugh at ourselves. You know, we really laugh at ourselves sometimes. It's so ludicrous. I mean, AA has given us everything that we have. Our biggest problem today is the earthquake that was recently in California kind of trashed our house a little bit, and it's not a big deal. I mean, we have earthquake insurance, and I mean, we're getting it fixed. You know, we're going to get it fixed, and it actually will be better than it was because it will sort of improve as we go along. You know what I mean? Do some things that we meant to do. You know how you have stuff on the list you're going to do someday to the house? Well, now here's a reason to do it. And so it's probably going to turn out to be a good thing, you know. But, God, if you'd heard us the week that it happened talking about it, you would have just thought it was the biggest tragedy in the world. I have to tell you my earthquake story. In 1971, there was a big earthquake in California. I was still drinking at the time. And I was at that time working as a church secretary. That's kind of funny, isn't it? And this earthquake happened. It was not very close to where I lived. I lived in this apartment and pretty far away from where it happened. But, you know, there was a little shaking and a couple of pictures fell off the wall and, you know, a couple of little knickknacks broke, but that was it. But I had a terrible, terrible hangover that day. So I called into the church office and I said, oh, God, the earthquake, terrible damage. All my dishes, all my glasses broke. I'm going to have to take the day off and clean this terrible mess up. And, oh, they were so sympathetic and by all means take the day off. And kind of parlayed it into 3 or 4 days off, you know, and I went back to work then on the third or fourth day, and the ladies in this church had taken up a collection and bought me a new set of dishes. And I'll tell you, I felt real bad about that. I felt terrible about it. I never could use those dishes. I finally gave them away. I couldn't stand to look at those dishes. And when this earthquake happened the other day and we really did have some significant damage, I kind of thought, it's just God's sense of humor. You know, it really is. He just kind of laid back there and waited for an opportune moment to kind of get me. And I like to think that my God has a good sense of humor. I want to talk about one other thing and then I'll sit down. God, I hope I can do this. When I got sober, I really, really hated my stepfather. My mother married my stepfather when I was 8 years old, and I really hated this man a lot when I got sober. And I had very, actually, good reason to hate him. There was some stuff going on in my house that shouldn't have been going on when I was growing up, and I just hated him, and that's the way it was. I did not see it as a significant problem today, because I'm grown. I don't live in that house anymore. I haven't lived there in a long time. But I just hated him, and that's that. It was one of those secrets, you know, that I was going to take to my grave that I was never, ever going to tell anybody, because I never had. I did write about it in my inventory, and it's the hardest thing I ever did was read that part of my inventory to my sponsor. But I thought that night as I was driving home from my sponsor's house after I'd done that, that was going to be it. Like, whew, thank God I did that. I don't ever have to think about that again. Well, I was wrong. The longer I stayed sober, it seemed like he was still married to my mother, and the longer I stayed sober, the harder it got to be for me to, you know, when I called my mother or went out to see her on weekends, the harder it got to be cordial and polite and stuff to him. And seemed like the longer I stayed sober, the more I thought about it all and the crazier I was getting. And I don't know if this happens to you, but it seems to me whenever I'm going through something, every meeting I go to, that's exactly what they're talking about. And what I was hearing in meetings was that resentments kill alcoholics, especially justifiable resentments, and that we must find a way to get rid of them or we will surely drink and die. It seemed like every speaker leaned right into the microphone and said it just like that. And it made me crazy. And I knew that I had to find a way to get rid of the resentment, but I didn't know how. I prayed about it every night. Dear God, please take this resentment away. And nothing happened. If you're new, I'll give you a little hint here. It is my experience, since I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I can never get on my knees and ask God to do anything and have anything at all happen, if that's all I've done. It seems to me my job is to get on my knees, ask God for the help, and then get up and do whatever the footwork on my part is. And there always, always is some footwork. I finally went and talked to my sponsor about it because I was so crazy, and she told me a terrible thing. She told me I was going to have to make amends to this stepfather. I said, you know, maybe you don't remember the exact circumstances of the inventory. Maybe I ought to run that by you again. And she said, no, we're not taking his inventory here. You know, we're concerned with your side of the street. And sure, and I said, yeah, but when I was a kid, you know, he was wrong. And she said, you got to take your focus off of that. I was sober maybe 3 years before I got around to doing this. I'm sorry to say. You don't have to wait that long if you're new. She said, Pat, you made amends to your mother now a long time ago for the, you know, the grief, the anguish, the worry, the stuff we put our parents through. That man was living in the house at the same time you were causing your mother all this grief. Why don't you just sort of take that same list of things and make amends to him? Use that as the basis for your amends. And I didn't want to. See, I love my mother. I've always loved my mother. I felt terrible that I caused my mother all that grief. I felt awful that I hurt my mother so much. I despised this man. What do I care if he was a little worried, you know? But I didn't want to drink. And so I went out and I talked to him one day, and I told him I knew I hadn't been a very good stepdaughter and that I was sorry about that, that I was going to try to be a better one from now on. And I kind of left right away because I was afraid that if I stuck around, I might drift off into discussing his shortcomings. And my sponsor had been quite clear on the fact that we were not to do that. And so I left, and I was driving back home, and I thought, well, these steps don't work in every area of your life. Because I've done it. I went out there and I talked to him, and I still hate him as much as I ever did. In fact, it seems like talking to him made it worse somehow. And I went back and I talked to my sponsor again, and she said, you have to do just like you did with your late husband. You got to act like a kind and loving daughter every day to this man. I didn't want to do it, but bottom line, I didn't want to drink. And so I started trying to do that. The first thing that I did is every week when I called my mother, if he answered the phone, instead of saying, let me talk to Mom, I would say, hello, how are you? Let me talk to Mom. It may not sound like a big deal to you, but I'll tell you what, it was a major deal the first 30 or 35 times I did it. I would be sweating when I would dial the phone. I was so uncomfortable talking to this man. And I thought, you know, a kind and loving daughter might actually chat with him about something. And I certainly had nothing I cared to chat with him about, but I would think of two topics of conversation before I dialed the phone that I thought tonight. I think of these as generic topics, you know. If I'd seen a movie that week, that was a good topic. When the Olympics were in L.A., that was great. God, I used that for weeks, you know. And so I'd call and I'd say, hello, how are you? And he'd respond, and I'd talk about my first little topic, and he'd respond appropriately, and then I'd talk about my second little topic, and he'd respond, and by now I'm dripping wet, and then I'd ask to talk to Mom, you know. And when I would go down to visit, I would, instead of just, you know, leaping off in the car and going somewhere with her, I would take a few minutes to chat with him and visit with him and ask him how he was doing. And Christmas was coming up that first year I started doing this, and a woman said to me, you know, Pat, a kind and loving daughter would not rush out on Christmas Eve, pick up a shirt, and have the store wrap it. I don't know how she knew I was planning to do that. I thought, well, okay. I remember I went home and I sat on the couch and I said, okay, God, I am willing to get this man something that he might use or like or appreciate. I have not a clue what that might be. So you're going to have to give me a little inspiration here. And I sat on the couch and I waited for inspiration to strike and nothing happened. Finally thought, well, maybe the footwork here would be to go like to a shopping mall, you know, where stuff is, and maybe inspiration could strike easier. And so I did that. I got dressed, and I don't particularly like to shop, so it was kind of an ordeal. And I go down to the shopping mall, and I'm walking around, and I went in a needlepoint store, and there was a thing on the wall to needlepoint, a saying about fathers and daughters, a sickening saying about fathers, just, you would not believe. And, you know, it's a frame, needlepoint frame, and hang on the wall. And I thought, no, I can't. And I looked for other things frantically, but I just, like, it was pulling me, you know, so I bought it, and I, you know, needlepoint takes some hours, and I did my nicest work. I never for a moment felt the sentiment, but I did my nicest work. I framed it very nicely. I wrapped it up. I took it over there at Christmas time, and there was a moment that Christmas, a spiritual experience, in fact, I don't know if I can get through this, where he opened that gift, and he got a little tear in the corner of his eye, and I knew, it was a powerful moment. I knew in that second I was doing the right thing. I knew in that second that if I kept doing what I was trying to do, that God was going to make this resentment bearable enough that I would not have to pick up a drink over it. Understand that I hated him as much as I ever hated him. I just knew in that little split second that somehow, if I kept trying to do this, God was going to make it okay. I did not know how. I kept marching along, doing what I, you know, and it seems like when I get involved in trying to do something like this, the more ideas I get, you know, to sort of implement it, and that's what happened. And time passed, a lot of time passed, and a few years. And he was in the hospital one time, and I went down to visit him. And when I got up to leave, I bent over and I kissed him on the forehead, and I said, goodbye, I love you. And the truth of the matter is, I did. And, you know, it's just like what happened to my late husband. It didn't happen that day in the hospital. It happened a long time before that day in the hospital, and I missed it. You know, I missed when that terrible resentment went away. I remember I was walking out of my car that night, and I was crying. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe that this terrible, terrible resentment was gone. What I felt for him that night was a lot of compassion. He was a practicing alcoholic when I was growing up, and into my adulthood, for that matter. And I believed that he was doing the best he could do. And that's just pretty much the way I felt about it. Three weeks ago, he committed suicide. I'll tell you what, I'm very, very grateful I did this stuff. You know, I feel terrible about the way he died. It was so sad, but you know what? There was nothing that I had left unsaid. He jumped off the roof of his house and he lived for a week, but he was not conscious. I went to the hospital every day and I sat by his bed and I held his hand in case he would wake up. But you know what? I never for a moment sat there and thought, I wish he would wake up so I could tell him this or that. Because I've said it all. For years now, I have been, in fact, a kind and loving daughter to this man because of what you taught me. You know, you taught me I just have to clean up my side of the street. God, I hate doing this. This is so ridiculous. You taught me to clean up my side of the street and everything else would take care of itself. And it did. It really did. If you're new, God, I hate to leave on this kind of a note here. Jesus. If you're new, I got to tell you, AA works. I mean, it really, really works. My life is so incredibly good. It is so incredibly good. The gifts that I've been given here are beyond my wildest imagination. When I was new in AA, I'd hear people say, and I used to hate it, I'd hear people say, if I'd gotten everything I wished for when I was new in AA, I would have really shortchanged myself. I'd sit in the meeting and I'd think, not me. I got big ideas. I got big dreams. You know, maybe you shortchanged yourself, but not me. I'll tell you what, I wouldn't have even come close. I didn't even have the notions to dream the way that I live my life today, the way that I feel, the relationships that I have with my family, the ones that are here and the ones that are no longer here. You know, what a gift you have given me. I hope that nobody in this room ever has to take another drink again. I'm very, very happy to be sober. Thank you.